Welcome, everyone. Hello, Amit. Wonderful to meet you. So for listeners of the India Explained podcast who are still around and who still have, you know, maybe not hit unsubscribe because we've been on a long hiatus, welcome back. You know, we've been on a break, as I said, but one of the ways we are kickstarting the podcast again is through a separate series in addition to the regular chats that Bunty and I have. We are starting something called India Explained Conversations, which will be with you know, interesting, creative, thoughtful, insightful people from all walks of life. Their views centered on India, but not limited exclusively to India, given the sort of cliche with some truth that we live in a global world. And inaugurating this series, I'm delighted to have with me today Amit Verma. Amit, you know, we'll need no introduction to people in the podcast world, in the media world. He is a writer, he's been a journalist, he's a blogger, he's a podcaster, he's a thinker. I will only mention a couple of things before we jump into the sort of freewheeling conversation on, you know, politics, art, culture, media in India and the world. That I followed Amit's blog, India Uncut, for many years. I follow his newsletter now. I follow his podcasts. And, you know, I had the privilege of meeting Amit 5 or 6 years ago, I think, 2016, 17, in India. And he reached out when, you know, I was on social media. And he said, let's meet. It was very kind of him. We planned to meet for lunch, I remember, near Colaba, sometime a wonderful restaurant right across the Taj. I forget its name, terrible memory, sort of hitting, you know, middle age and all of that. But we met around maybe 12, 12:30. And we wound up hanging out for about 10 hours, I think. We went from Colaba to Worli, met another friend of Amit's, a lovely chap. And it was as if, you know, I'd known him all my life. So it was a 10-hour, wonderful chat, not interrupted, but punctuated by wonderful meal. So Amit, delighted to have you here, and thank you. So let's just, you know, jump into this. I want to just start first by getting your sense of, like, what is the lie of the land right now in India, according to you? And I'll just leave it at that, and we can, you know, take it from there.
Yeah, first up, I'm just so happy to be talking with you again, and that was a very memorable day we kind of spent together, and I just loved how, you know, sometimes you meet someone and you just get into a groove. You're like right there, you're meeting them for the first time, but you're just in the groove, and so that was a great day, and I hope we have many more days like that. The lay of the land, boss, is really depressing. The lay of the land is that, you know, on Twitter, it often seems as if there are two sides. But if you actually look at our society and you look at what's happening around you, it makes me realize more and more that I am just in this small bubble, that, you know, all my life I've grown up in this English-speaking urban bubble in India and had the illusion that, hey, we are broadly liberal, we are broadly secular, theek hai, you know, baki sab fringes hai. And then you realize what a small bubble you are and what the country is really like. And an illustration of this, Rohit, is that, you know, the recent judgments, which I know disturbed you and we'll no doubt talk about, like releasing Bilkis Bano's killers, one thug got Srikant Tyagi got released on the day that we are recording this, I believe. And even earlier, if you look at things like Pragya Thakur being made an MP and so on and so forth, all of these are not actions that are being done because somebody high up is making a point. All of these are actions because the people making these decisions know that they will be popular, right? My good friend Nilanjana Roy posted a tweet earlier today where, you know, and we are recording this, what's the date today, on 21st? 21st October, yes. Yeah. And she posted a tweet about how some editor somewhere told her that these releases and these decisions are being taken because elections are coming. And that indicates that these are popular decisions. And that indicates how far the othering of Muslims has gone in India at this point in time, right? And, you know, so the predominant sort of politics of the time is this anti-Muslim strain that is kind of playing out, where it almost feels like it got ramped up this year, where almost, you know, earlier this year there was a phase where almost every day for 2 or 3 weeks there was some damn incident somewhere happening and people just behaving with impunity. And as Nilanjana pointed out in the Bilkis Bano case, releasing these people is not just a slap on the face of all Muslims, but a slap on the face of all women. You know, you're releasing people who gang raped this woman, who slaughtered her family, who killed a baby in front of her. And you're releasing them and people are garlanding them and they're cheering and all of that. And so, you know, I don't even want to get into things like, you know, what was the court thinking or whatever, where those, forget all of that. This is a popular sentiment and it is depressing. And I don't know what to say beyond that.
Well, you raise many excellent points. And, you know, my thinking, my gut reaction was this comes from the top. But the point you're making is that it is, these decisions are taken semi-autonomously, if not entirely autonomously, with the knowledge also that they will have, if not the blessings, outright blessings, there will be no pushback from the top. And that's a very interesting distinction. That raises one point in itself, which is a separate issue, which is just about, you know, the very interesting structure of accountability and deniability that the Hindu right works with. The high ups can always say, but I had nothing to do with it, but you know, it's all sort of coming with their blessings. Let me just pursue this a little further. I know it's a depressing state of affairs. And I was, you know, exactly of the same thinking mindset as you. I always, you know, as I sort of grew older and by virtue of, you know, just being in academia, reading and working on secularism, the idea of India as this bastion of, you know, religious tolerance, pluralism, always seemed a bit of a, somewhat of a romantic, exceptionalist narrative to me. But I always believed that there was some kind of underlying basis of truth to it, right? And to me, when I think back on, 2010, 2012, that time, or 2012 to 14, maybe, I would say, I think so many people, including people with right-wing sympathies, did not think that Narendra Modi would even be the prime ministerial candidate, and that Indians would not stand for it. That was the belief across the political spectrum. So again, it's the question I want to run with here is that, was that just a kind of like fiction that was sustaining us all of this while? You know, one Akhil Bilgrami, in an early piece he wrote on Indian secularism, said that secularism was basically just a holding process. And his point was that it could not gain, you know, widespread legitimacy. But there have been others who have suggested that, in its formal institutional sense, no matter how battered it seems, there is still perhaps something in Indian society that coheres. I'm not optimistic because to me, the terrifying thing is, you know, neither the Aam Aadmi Party nor the Congress, barring a few kind of remarks from Rahul Gandhi, which is another story in itself, have come out against this. And this incident is so beyond the pale that it has, you know, I talk to people in India, I talk to people here, it's just, you know, just sort of stunned everyone. So was it, you know, is it just one of, you know, those Tom and Jerry cartoons or those Disney cartoons, Roadrunner, where the guy goes off the cliff, but he keeps running in the air, and only when he looks down and realizes that there's no ground beneath his feet, he then plummets. Is that kind of what's been happening? Have we been, you know, living this notion of pluralism as a, based on this illusion, whether in the urban context or the rural context or the semi-urban context?
Yeah, great points. And I love the image of you and I sort of careening down a cliff once we look down. And so here's the thing, a couple of points. One is that there's that old cliche or whatever you say about India, the opposite is also true. I was once chatting with JP Narayan and episode 149 of The Seen and the Unseen, and we were I was making the point that we are a deeply illiberal society, and the reasons are so obvious, you know, the way women are treated, our caste problem, deeply illiberal. But what JP said was, he agreed, of course, but he said that, I looked at it another way, you could also say that we are deeply liberal in the sense that if you look at our if you look at our cuisines, if you look at our clothes, you know, the Prime Minister himself wears, clothes of an Islamic origin, the elegant Chuidar Kurtas.
Yeah.
If you look at our languages, if you look at all of these things, we're a delightful melting pot. So somewhere in our lived experience also, there is some liberalism. So I think the hope that many like you and I once had, or the mistaken belief that many like you and I once had, wasn't entirely without foundation. There was something to that. However, here's what we missed, and this is a theme I keep going back to on my show with various guests, is that at our founding moment, or at our founding moment of this particular young nation state, in the late 40s, the path that we chose was to look at society, realize how deeply illiberal it is, and decide that we will change it from the top down. So you have a liberal constitution, not as liberal as I would like, but more liberal than society, being imposed upon an illiberal society. And there's a separate meta question of how liberal can that imposition be. But the expectation was that eventually, these values will percolate down, that in some sense, as Madhav Chopra says, the constitution is a pedagogic exercise as well, that you are in a sense teaching a society how to behave. And in hindsight, that seems so incredibly arrogant and bound to fail, because if you think of it from the top down, it's not going to work. Now, Gandhiji, of course, said that it has to happen from the bottom up, culture has to change from within. And there is some truth to that, but there is also the problem that, as Ambedkar correctly said, our villages were and are, dens of vice and, advice and bigotry and whatever, I forget his precise words, but we know how they are. I had a recent episode with the great Dalit scholar Chandraban Prasad, where he talks about the ongoing battle which lasted decades between village republics and the Indian Republic, which tells you how hard it is to change culture. Now, I think what has happened is that not only was society not changed from the top down, but politics has finally caught up with society. The politics that you see today is not an aberration. You know, the bigotry that you see in our politics, the hatred that you see in our politics, misogyny that you see in our politics has all been part of our society. You know, Akshay Mukul has a great book on the Gita Press, a history of the Gita Press, and I had an episode with him as well. Speaks about how literally for more than 100 years now, these have been life political issues. You know, love jihad and cow slaughter. These are not issues of today or 10 years ago or 8 years ago. These did not start in 2014. These were happening in the 1910s. These were happening in the 1920s, right? So our societies always kind of had these dominant strains within it, and that's kind of where we are. And I think that is also a wake-up call for people like you and me, that we should not feel entitled to our vision of India, ki secular hona chahiye, liberal hona chahiye, kyun nahi hai? No, we have to fight for it. We have to fight for it in the battle place of ideas and not get complacent ki yaar constitution hai, laws hai, courts hai. We can't do that. We have to, if we have a particular vision of what we want India to be, we have to fight for it, and fight for it in the marketplace of ideas and, and do what we have to there.
So wonderful points. And if there's so many things, I mean, each of these strands I could respond to, but I will find that urgent. Let me move here to, the role of the internet and social media, right, in all of this, right? We know that there's a sort of clear recent record of Facebook in places like Myanmar and Sri Lanka being complicit in genocide. We see the stuff that happens. I don't think either of us need to like recount or, the kind of trolling that happens, or the kind of takeover of the Twitter space and the online space by the Hindu right, the BJP IT cell and so on, shutting down all kinds of voices. There's also something that I found very disturbing, which is this, whole phenomenon of the circulation of spectacular violence, as it were, where on the one hand, yes, it becomes a form of evidence, but there's almost this sadistic glee. It's part of this, apparatus of ritual humiliation of Muslims or Dalits, where people are subjected to gross violence, and then those clips circulate online. Now, in combining that with, the point that you mentioned in your conversation with Chandrabhan Prasad and the insights that this is something that is not new, right? And this was always happening. It's just that we were in our bubbles, cut off from it. What role has social media really played in fomenting and exacerbating this violence? And this is an area I work on, but one of the points that, another scholar made to me is that he said, we perhaps the power that we attribute to social media in the changes we see in India, the social, political, cultural changes, might be exaggerated. So in your understanding, how have the sort of, to use that very crude dichotomy, the online and offline interacted, and what has the role of social media been in leading to this state of affairs in the Indian context?
So I think social media's played a huge role in this. Now, on the whole, I think the internet and technology and the connectivity that we have, which can allow people like you and I to come together and talk, is on the whole a hugely net positive. However, a large chunk of our current problems are because of social media, and I don't even think that they are willful, that social media is willfully evil or something, right? It just worked out this way. Right. So let me like dig a little bit into this. One, there's a great book of sociology by Timur Kuran called Public Lies, Private Truths, or the other way around, Private Truths, I think it's Public Lies, Private Truths, where he came up with the phrase preference falsification. Now, what is preference falsification? Let's say that I hold a belief that people around me won't hold. I will not state my belief because I will not want to get into trouble or embarrass somebody or be looked down upon and so on. The example Quran gives, I think, is the Soviet era, where, for a long period of time, no one dissented openly because they didn't know there were other dissenters. They thought, if I'm the only one to dissent, I'll get knocked down. And then there was suddenly what Quran calls a preference cascade, that you suddenly realize that there are other dissenters, as almost everyone is a dissenter, it's okay to dissent, and then they all express their dissenter. So to the outside observer, it seems that all these people have suddenly come to the same conclusion all at once, but it's not all at once. They held it all the time, and it's only now that it's found expression. Now, I think a similar thing happened in India via social media, that I think many people had beliefs that they would not express in public. Now, we can, in a pejorative way, call them bigoted or sexist or whatever. And that's true. But they wouldn't say those things in public because, it just felt that, you'll be looked down upon if you say that. And what social media did was you suddenly went on Twitter and Facebook and realized that, hey, there are many other people who share these beliefs, and hey, they are very loud. And, the more and more people get validation, the more and more they start expressing. And suddenly, even in the real world, they look around and they realize that this is it. They are the majority, a feeling of you found your tribe, you belong to it, that you don't have to be ashamed of, whatever disgusting belief you hold. So you had a preference cascade that I think played a large part in, building the Modi wave and bringing him to power and all of that. And that is one thing that's responsible for our current times. Now, what also happens because of social media is that there is an incentive to swing to the extremes, in the sense that, let's say I go online, right? I want to belong. I want to be liked. So I find a tribe. I'm part of a tribe, right? Then how do I raise my status within the tribe? I can only do it by swinging to the extremes, by attacking people on the other side, never engaging with arguments, just attacking people, or by attacking people on my own side for not being pure enough, right? Which is why everybody is hating on centrists, for example, whoever they are. And what that does is that leads to the discourse becoming toxic, focused on people rather than ideas and policies and thoughts, and everybody is incentivized to swing to the extreme, and the extreme is a crazy place. Like, if you remember last year, those Dharam Sansad videos where these different Hindu sadhus came on the same stage, and each one of them is outdoing the other in terms of the things that they are saying. Now, my thesis is, if there was one guy on that stage, he would not have said the kind of extreme things he did. But there are all these people, they have to compete for the same rabid audience, and therefore they are outdoing each other in wildness, and it becomes competitive. And the same thing really honestly happens on the left as well. So you have these incentives which push you to the extremes, and this works within parties itself. It's not just social media. Within a particular party, how do you rise? The Congress, of course, is a separate case because it's not really a political party in that sense. It's a feudal setup. But within a party, how do you rise? If you look at the internecine battles in the BJP below the whole Modi Shah thing, it's all about swinging to the extremes. And that is incentivized in today's politics, and that is all that you get. And my sense is that the people you see swinging to the extremes in tribalistic ways online at least, are vocal minorities, but they are so incredibly vocal that it seems that they are all the people. But the silent majority, a lot of the time, doesn't really give a shit. They are, but even that silent majority, if you look at voting patterns and trends and all of that, they are definitely much more towards Hindutva today than otherwise. Now, the big open question here is that what is a core Hindutva vote per se? Like, if you say that today politics is so much centered around being anti-Muslim, what is a percentage of that vote? We don't know that. You know, there are, for example, in 2019, a lot of the UP vote in that landslide was because of welfare delivery and reasons like that. So I think what we still don't know is, you know, what percentage of the vote is because of all the things that we don't like about this political movement, and what percentage of it is because of other reasons which can then be addressed. But I wouldn't be too optimistic, because like you correctly pointed out, I mean, both the Aam Aadmi Party and the Congress hasn't really gone out of their way to oppose these aspects of Hindutva, right? The Aam Aadmi Party, in fact, is playing to the same vote bank, the exact same vote bank, only they are adding other nuances to it, but they are completely happy playing to the bigots. You look at their statements at the time Article 370 was repealed in Kashmir, for example. So if these seasoned political parties have the view that the Hindu vote is too strong, you can't go against it, you have to quote it, then that worries me. And I don't know whether that is the way it is, or whether it's a failure of imagination on the part of political parties to figure out other margins where they can appeal to people and get votes.
Yeah, well, thank you. There's, again, you know, a wealth of insights, there's strands that we can mine. And I think I'll just respond briefly to a couple of points. I think you're absolutely right that I think the BJP already wound up winning when it managed to change the logic of political argument, that it redefined the terms of the game, where it wasn't about, you know, whether you were a Hindutvavadi or not, but it was really about, to what extent could you show that you agreed with some of the tenets of Hindutva. You had to play your Hinduism, right? I mean, I don't consider myself an expert on Indian politics, but I've just, you know, followed by virtue of being my research and being an interested, you know, sort of person of Indian origin in the West now for many years, followed Indian politics. At some point of time, it was a great surprise to me when Rahul Gandhi suddenly declared that he was a Shiv Bhakt, right? This was a few years ago, and the same thing. So this very sort of public performance of Hinduism, that is now the logic of the political field. And again, it's a really interesting point you make about psychological motivation for, you know, what motivates people, what are the different things that motivate people to vote for the Hindu right. There is definitely that core element of, you know, Hindutva, but it also is combined with these other things. And, you know, one of the sad things in this respect, but about this, is that it also tells us that there's a crying need for fine journalism, nuanced on-the-ground journalism. And I know that, you know, I was speaking to a journalist who's actually got a really interesting book coming out on Hindutva on the ground in rural areas in India. And perhaps one of the things he looks at is how does social media feed into that? Because that at that level, but also these fine-grained, I think, empirical studies about, you know, what's happening in different states. But the alarming thing is that precisely when we have a crying need for this kind of scholarship, and there's always a crying need for, I think, good research of any kind, scholarship or by journalists, the BJP government has suddenly been cracking down on anyone, you know, who works on Hindu nationalism, anyone who could come up with anything, I think, that challenges their narrative. So that may be, you know, something that we can just talk about a little bit about, you know, to me, what seems like, in one sense, a paradox, but in other sense, perhaps not quite a paradox. And it really the kind of complete obliteration of civil society and the clamping down on any kind of free expression. You know, there's this journalist in Washington, D.C., Sadanand Dhume, and in 15, 16, 17, when we first started seeing this, he would sneer and snigger and mock at people, saying that, you know, what are people talking about? With freedom and impunity, people can criticize Modi. But I think the people who said that, you know, that things are already changing and worse is coming, I think they were on to something. And now we find that, you know, Angad Singh being denied entry because he made that film about COVID. There is a fairly clear, well-documented record of the incompetence of Modi. And I don't say this because I disagree with Modi or the BJP's politics. I mean, there's, you know, well-documented records of the incompetence of every government in India. But, you know, whether it's the sort of fiasco of demonetization, whether it's the tragedy of, like, you know, what happened with preventable deaths in COVID, these horrific images of bodies being just, you know, left in the Ganga, you know, the policy with China, which is at this rate you know, my guess is in 4 years they'll be camping outside, you know, Modi's bedroom. But you know, any even a mild criticism on social media gets the BJP after you. So the question, sorry for this ramble, is if Mr. Modi is so all powerful in the eyes of his supporters, if he is an incarnation of Vishnu or Ram, as Venkaiah Naidu and Amit Shah have claimed, why this level of insecurity? You know, if we are a superpower already, because, you know, there's things that Bhakts get joy about. Sultan of Oman gave Modi extra kiss, hug by Biden was tighter, every little thing, his picture is everywhere, right? If there is this ubiquity, if he is so successful, if it is a done deal, if he has destroyed and decimated the Congress, what is the terror of free speech and criticism? Like, you know, what would your thoughts be on that?
My thoughts are, you're right, obviously. The environment is pretty bad, you know, where does one even start? But first I'll say that, you know, Sadanand Dhume is a good friend of mine. And you know, he did support Modi for reasons I understand in 2014, 2015. I thought during that period of time, if someone is, you know, supporting that, there are reasonable reasons to do so. The disastrous governance of the 70 years before that, everything that was happening before then. But you had to have changed your mind by the time demonetization came around, because it was by that time evident that these guys are a disaster in every way possible. So, you know, at the time that I was writing out furious article after article against demonetization, so was Sadanand. He called it batshit crazy, and he's been very rigorous at sort of opposing them and writing about all the things that they do wrong since then. So I think, you know, some of the flack the guy gets is a little unjustified. Now, the thing is that there are different elements to this. And here are some of the different elements. One is that, as I pointed out, for a bunch of years in the Times of India, I you know, wrote against the Modi government, and it was fine. You know, even during demon, in fact, one of the fundamental pieces that went viral after demon, slamming demon, was retweeted, which I wrote for Times, was retweeted by, you know, both Kejriwal and Rahul Gandhi. So, it was so there was dissent happening, but the point is gradually that changed. Now there are many different aspects to it. One is that initially, at one point in time, they did not really care for English speaking dissenters, right? So they would crack down on people in the languages, because their perception was ki ye English wale to Latians wale hai, and it's okay, and they'll crack down on dissenters. So if you look at, for example, the great free thinkers who got assassinated, like Gauri Lankesh and Dabolkar and so on,
right.
they were all writing in the languages, and that scared the shit out of them. They just looked at Latians elite, and I suppose they would pop you and I into that category, the both of us are nowhere near Latians, say that these people are irrelevant. Now, that started changing over a period of time. One, it started changing because one thing that the Prime Minister really does care about is his image abroad, right? So whenever you find a Barkhadat writing for Washington Post, or, you know, Rana Ayub writing for whoever, some foreign publication, or New York Times criticizing you, then that gets their rankles up. And then they start to, you know, look at those people and crack down on that. And that's definitely happened. What's also happened is that, you know, in my case, I mentioned this in my recent episode with Samarth Bansal. In my case, the newspaper that I wrote for, the editor called me in tears once just before my piece was about to go up, and she said, look, I have to cut this sentence out because it is too anti-Modi, and I have been told by my higher-ups, that is the chief editor himself, that there's too much pressure from the top, right? So we got to kind of let this line go. And what do you want to do? Because at that time, because they knew that I am the kind of finicky columnist, even if you take change a word or two, you really need to check with me, and I'll be pretty adamant about certain things. And the rest of the piece was still anti-Modi. It was just that one line which was very whatever. So I said, "Theek hai, cut it out." And then I thought about what should I do. I thought if I give up this space, it might go to a pro-administration person. Yeah. So should I give it up? Eventually, I gave it up after writing 2-3 more pieces. Another columnist who was in the exact same spot as me, and who has been harassed subsequently in much worse ways, including having his passport impounded, chose to give up his column at the the time. So they, so sometimes I noticed, but the crackdown was not because of me. The crackdown was because it came in Times of India, which, so they started looking at these big guys. Now, the one, of course, the mainstream is crumbling because of structural reasons everywhere in the world. So mainstream media was going to die anyway. But what these guys have done, and this is a political angle to this, is that all our mainstream media houses are owned by people who have other business interests as well. So you may own a newspaper, but you also own a chemical factory. Wahan pe raid karwa diya, right? Yeah, yeah. So which is why you will not really find much meaningful dissent happening from any of these major papers. You know, Bobby Ghosh was asked to leave as editor of HT, and he was doing such a good job.
Because of the hate tracker and all that, right?
And it was basically the orders came from the minister, from the central ministry, that nikalo isko. So overnight they got the editor-in-chief of a major newspaper change. So that's the level of interference that there is. However, I haven't given up hope, because you do have independent media which is doing its journalism fearlessly. People like, you know, Alt News and Scroll and, you know, the News Minute and News Laundry and so on and so forth. And even here, there are nuances between the different players, and we can talk about it later. But you have sort of, you know, technology empowers all of us. You and I can have this chat today over the internet. And that's a wonderfully empowering thing of technology. And this would, for example, if Indira Gandhi was doing the emergency today, I would certainly be in jail. You know, you are in another country, so you would be fine. But she locked up every dissenter, including the all the opposition in terms of politics. And, you know, we know what kind of happened there. And she also, like Modi, had this sort of obsession with what the foreign media thinks of her. And, she, you know, so when they started criticizing what she is doing, she figured, hey, I got to redeem myself. And she was under the delusional belief that, you know, that she would win the elections. She called the elections. Her son, Sanjay Gandhi, sort of advised her against it. But she called them, and we know what, and we're kind of lucky that she suffered from that delusion and that regard for the foreign press. Otherwise, who knows? So, you know, so some of us still have a voice. I think the reason we have a voice is partly because inertia, like these guys can shut us down any moment. You know, they can shut me down any moment. What is to stop them? Right. It's just that on the one hand, they might be inertia. On the other hand, you know, we are just too small fry for them. Even now, you know, if this was, you know, if your podcast was an official Times of India podcast, it would not be there. Right, but you are sitting somewhere and you are doing it, and no one can stop you. And that's ultimately my great hope, you know, when it comes to raising a voice and speaking truth to power, that institutions are not going to do it. You know, if you look at the structure of all our institutions and the way the incentives are aligned, do not expect anything from any of our institutions. But, you know, individuals are empowered to stand up and speak up and make their voice heard. And that is a great hope, whether it is this regime in power or 10 years later, some other regime.
So wonderful. Like, the several things again come to mind. And one, Timothy Garton Ash has a wonderful book, 10, the 10 Principles of Speech for a Connected World. I think that's the subtitle. And he has this notion where he talks about individual word power. And he's, you know, obviously he's not a techno-utopianist. But he does, you know, say that, of course, you know, it's everyone who's on YouTube is not going to make $1 billion like Mr. Beast. Or, you know, I think we are past that stage when, you know, well past that line of thinking. I actually worked in the Indian internet industry in the late 90s. And I remember that moment of when everyone believed that this would be lead to this new kind of world where, you know, all voices would ring equally true and would have the same weight. So we know that didn't happen, but the potential is definitely real. And I think that's something we have to hang on to. And you know, we also hang on to stories. And the reason I say that is my, you know, I think of an incident, my father-in-law was, you know, he was, he had been outspoken against the emergency in certain contexts. He's now a retired professor. He was also, he did some, you know, work with the People's Union for Civil Liberties and so on. And during the emergency, he actually had someone from the Intelligence Bureau, whatever the agency was, actually following him. And there was a day when he was at the bus stop and this gentleman was following him. He saw the gentleman. And the bus was late and my father-in-law had to go to college, so he decided to take a cab. So he went up to this person and said, he said, "Look, I know you're following me. Why don't you get into the taxi with me?" And he said, the person was very civil. He said, "I know you're a professor. This is my job." And, they didn't become great buddies or something, but they kept in touch after the emergency. So, to me, that in some ways, I know that, it's just one incident, but it just, one just hopes there is something beneath the institutional roles we are given. And there is something beneath ideological commitments, too. I think of, Rana Ayoob, at some point of time, there was this horrible incident where some, people, some, again, people with loose affiliations to the Hindu right, but adherence to the ideology, they morphed some pornographic images and circulated them. And the person who informed her was actually a member of the RSS. Now, this doesn't mean that the RSS has, sort of become the new liberal party. But the fact that there is someone in there who, despite being part of that structure, has some sense of, what is beyond the pale. And, is maybe that there is just a sliver of hope out there. And as you say, if there are enough voices, the same logic that you mentioned of Timur Kuran, those, or Cass Sunstein calls cyber cascades, can kick in. Let me move a little towards the, global here. And there's something about the contradictions of Indian communities, if we have time, I'd like to come back to. But there's a more fundamental question I'd love to get your take on, which is, we see this sort of lurch to the right? And of course, there's particular local histories everywhere, like Meloni in Italy, Orban in Hungary, Putin, of course, with the war. Are we seeing some kind of move towards two things? One, are we seeing a move towards kind of global authoritarianism? Like, has there been some, long period of largely liberal peace, even with exceptions, that has now kind of ended? And the second question, which interests me particularly as a student of globalization, is, are we seeing a retreat from globalization? My quick and dirty take is no, we aren't. It's a kind of, it's part of a cyclical or a back and forth process, but a more turbulent form of globalization, perhaps. But, I'd love to hear what you have to say about both these issues. So rise to global authoritarianism, resurgence of global right, and, is it some kind of deglobalization or retreat from globalization?
Yeah, so, lovely questions, and I'll take a little shot at sharing my thoughts. But first of all, what you said about sort of the somebody from the RSS warning Rana is interesting, because I think one thing that we should also not do is think of the whole Hindutva ecosystem in India as one monolithic thing. We often get into this conspiracy theory kind of things, that is one monolithic thing, it's acting in the same way, but it's different sets of people with different kinds of incentives. And, and those nuances are something that one needs to keep in mind, which is not to absolve any of them. As far as these two questions are concerned, it's really hard to say at a given moment in time, right? Because we like to think of the world in teleological ways, that there are, that the world is moving in a particular direction, that the arc of justice, the arc of history is moving towards justice or freedom or whatever. And we like to think that there are these broad narratives, Fukuyama asking about the end of history, though obviously that was a much misinterpreted essay by him. But there was, at one point, perhaps, after the Berlin Wall comes down, the Soviet Union collapses, one can imagine asking that, okay, are we finally in are we going to have societies which are liberal and democratic and so on and so forth? Has that game been won? Is that over? And so it's what we see today is a turn away from that completely, and a turn away from globalization as well. But I agree with you that that doesn't mean globalization is over. Now, what we don't know is, there's one part of me which thinks that there is something fundamental about this shift. It is not something that will revert back to some imaginary mean or something like that, that there is something fundamental because politics in general through the centuries for all of human mankind has been something that elites have participated in. Broadly, elites set the policies, elites set the directions, and so on and so forth. Now, it's a good thing that that is no longer the case, that people have been empowered by social media and by media in general and technology to express themselves. But it also means that you get into a space that you, there is a danger of majoritarianism tendencies coming to the fore. And would these take you in an authoritarian direction? Because the people at large typically, look, how do we explain the world to ourselves? We explain the world to ourselves by telling stories about it. You know, so elites will have different ideologies and tribes that they believe in. But for most people, it is simple stories that work. You know, and like in 2016, Trump, you know, willingly or otherwise, hit upon this train where he figured that, okay, if I need to explain to middle America where have your jobs gone, I can give them two explanations. I can say your jobs are being shipped to China, or I can say that immigrants are taking your job. So now you have an anti-free trade, anti-globalization strand there and an anti-immigration strand there. And both these explanations are rubbish. They're not true. The truth is so nuanced. But you try to express that nuanced truth, only elites will understand you. The simple narratives work for common people, you know. So my worry is that simple narratives will often be simplistic and will, you know, play to people's worst instincts, such as, you know, such as tribalistic thinking, such as dividing the world into us and the other, and so on and so forth. So is that a fundamental shift that has happened? I don't know. I mean, it's a question. I'm not even theorizing. I'm just saying that, you know, these are possibilities that worry me. I would like to think that it's not a permanent shift, that we can swing it back, even if this specific structural change has taken place. Look, we contain multitudes. So someone who contains within her bigoted instincts or you know, so on and so forth, will also contain better instincts. They will want a better life for the children. They will want prosperity. They will all of these things. So I think the challenge of politicians and thinkers today is to figure out ways to appeal to the better angels of their nature. And, you know, and maybe that changes the game. As far as globalization is concerned, at the political level, yes, it's a problem. You know, with the US's anti-free trade moves, especially under Trump, with China becoming, you know, such a bogeyman for everyone, and so on and so forth. So, unfortunately, sadly, it seems like globalization has been hurt a bit. However, I think that, you know, it's been helped in ways that are much greater and irreversible. And by that, I mean the technology which connects all of us to everybody else. Like, I have lost count of the suburban housewives I have met here who watch K-dramas all day, right? And when I say I have lost count, I'm not going around all day meeting suburban housewives, but I'm a middle-aged man and I can't count too high anymore. So you know, I think in a certain sense, culture has become globalized. Our connectivity has become globalized. Like, I no longer live in just India, and you no longer live in just the US. You know, we are not restricted by geography anymore. The fact that you and I can talk and know each other and, you know, record this together is globalization, you know, even if you're both Indian. So there, I think that is irreversible. You're not going to change that. But so we have a lot of big questions up. And, at you know, if someone 50 years later listens to this podcast, they will see us as confused and incoherent, which is exactly what we are, because there's no other way. We are in the middle of things. We don't know how things are going to turn out.
In the moment, Well, it's, I completely agree with you. You know, on I don't think that genie is going back in the bottle. And one of the obvious ironies is that all these anti-globalization you know, movements, like whether it's, you think of Brexit or the Trump vote in 2016 in, you know, places like Michigan, the Rust Belt, which had suffered from deindustrialization, but which the Democrats had always taken for granted, or in Italy, or even the Hindu right, which to some extent, you know, the some segment of the population, which is in part, I think, projecting a kind of anger at being left out of the sort of goodies. The language they use, the discourse they use is so similar, is so standardized. You know, they borrow these terms from each other. So the language of anti-global populism is itself kind of global. But I, you know, we moving sort of towards a couple of other questions as we wind down, one of the things you mentioned earlier about the notion of, you know, we contain multitudes, notion of selfhood, and that plenitude of the self in terms of you know, what people are politically in terms of their aspiration, actually leads almost perfectly to a question I wanted to ask, that, you know, what's your take on this wokeness, you know, whether we understand wokeness as, in one sense, you know, perhaps it's caricatured as being a generational thing, perhaps it's, you know, unfairly or fairly described as being the view of a very small, you know, minority on the left, which holds, you know, the left or the progressive or liberals, whatever you want to call them, hostage. Because it seems to me that there is that kind of absolutism. And part of the problem, again, especially in spaces like Twitter, if you, you know, claim or you affect or identify yourself as sharing certain values which may be called plural or liberal or inclusive, is that if you don't toe the line from the very beginning, you're suspect. And in a sense, your views are predetermined by your identity. I mean, I've always been a person who's thought that there has been a very good space for identity politics, that identity politics did, you know, draw attention to a model of, to the limitations of a certain old model of politics and so on. But for instance, you know, I'll give you just personal examples that this is right about the time of the year where if you wish someone happy Diwali, and by the way, wish you a happy Diwali and wish our listeners happy Diwali, you become a, you know, you're a Savarna fascist and a casteist, right? So you can't even wish anyone Diwali. You can't even say that you celebrate Diwali. The fact of celebrating Diwali or wishing one becomes an act of oppression. To me, it's to use the term oppression also so loosely in some ways really takes away from other kinds of, you know, violence. Understanding that, you know, rituals, cultures, you know, are all ideologically sort of enmeshed. Or, you know, again, just a personal example, not to make this about me, but years ago, I just mentioned something about the television series Girls. And, you know, I said that there was something I found which is particularly ethnocentric and it wasn't reflexive enough. And, you know, some grad student called, you know, you're misogynistic for not liking Lena Dunham. And this, you know, so what are your thoughts about this? Because it seems to me like a, you know, destructive tendency. And I'm not one with all the critiques of wokeism that you see some of these, you know, stand-up comedians going on rants because they don't get to poke fun at trans people. That's not the line I'm towing. But it seems to me it's cut off a kind of way of thinking and conversation. And it's led to a really limited idea of the self.
No, I completely share your concerns. And I think what happens on both the right and the left are that people are drawn into these ideological tribes for reasonable reasons. For example, you could be, let's say, a conservative and get drawn to the Hindutva people because you care about your culture and you want that sense of community and all of that. And the bigotry and everything else that happens then comes later. So you could be drawn into it for good reasons, but once you're in, all that can become part of the package deal. And I think there's, you know, a similar danger with wokeness in the sense that, look, all liberals believe in what? Believe fundamentally in individual rights, that every individual has to, you know, you have to care for their freedom and their dignity. And part of respecting and regarding someone and an individual's dignity is to accept the fact that they contain multitudes, that they are not one thing, that you can't tie them down to one narrative and that they have agency. Now, I think what a danger in some identity politics is that it becomes essentializing, that you cannot escape your identity of birth, that whatever that identity of birth is, whether it is Hindu or Muslim or Savarna or this or that, you know, you are then bound up in a narrative of oppression or a narrative of victimhood where implicitly your individual agency is being disregarded, your circumstances are being disregarded, everything else that is part of the multitudes that you are, they are all being disregarded and you have to go along with this narrative. And I find that there is, you know, I think identity is really useful when you are analyzing the world, when you look at structures of oppression and where things have gone wrong and all of that, identity is useful. But then the way out of all the problems created by this kind of thinking is then to focus on individual rights and individual freedom and just to focus on that. But if you enter tribal warfare between A group and B group, then that's not helpful, that is toxic, and it is not even helpful to the people within within those ideologies. And I call it intellectual laziness, because what you're really doing is, in a complex world, you're choosing a simple narrative. Right, that if, for example, if you don't like female character or some series or whatever you were talking about, you know, it really becomes easy to slap a narrative onto that and say, oh, he's anti-woman, right? Or if you think Vinod Kambli was not a good batsman and, you know, not as good as Tendulkar, it's easy to slap a narrative to that and say, oh, you're casteist, right? And those narratives are so reductive. They are so insulting, not just to the people that you're forcing those narratives on, but also to you yourself. And those are so lazy. That's the point I want to make. You've got to realize that the world is complicated. If you just have one hammer for every nail, then you are, in a sense, hobbling yourself. You are not seeing the rest of what is going on. You're not seeing the rest of what is happening around you. So it becomes really simple then to just, you know, if that person's identity happens to be something that you can attack, it becomes really easy that, okay, just smash him with that. And that that results in a distressing tendency that we see from both the right and the left today. It's not just a wokeist, you know. I do say wokes and bhakts are so alike in so many different ways. But today, politically in India, bhakts are in power and therefore a greater danger. So we got to, accept that. But what therefore happens is that the discourse on social media reflects this in the sense that both the people on these sides are attacking people all the time. You know, Shekhar Gupta is this, or so-and-so is this, and Ram Guha gets attacked by both sides, Barkhadat gets attacked by both sides. And all these three people are fine people in different ways. But they all get attacked from both sides. And I would just say that if you're online, you know, I think it is okay to hold a public figure to account, especially someone like a Narendra Modi, who is being, you know, our taxpayers' money go into it. It's a democracy. He's got to be accountable. But apart from figures like that, apart from figures in politics and so on, why are you attacking people all the time? You know, let's talk about ideas. Let's talk about issues. Let a discussion be, on those subjects, instead of attacking people all the time. And so much of the time people get attacked on the basis of identity, and you're always looking for cheap gotcha moments, you said this, then you're saying this now, and so on and so forth. And I think that poisons the discourse. I think that we should always assume goodwill of everyone and not behave as if by default, they are bad faith actors and so on and so forth. Yeah. So a lot of our discourse is also kind of poisoned by this. Now, the point is, a lot of the people who get drawn to wokeism would get drawn because of, you know, the attractive rhetoric that it appears to be compassionate towards marginalized people and so on and so forth. And that is the essence of liberalism anyway, that we have to be, compassionate towards marginalized people and respect the individual rights of every single person and their agency and their dignity. But unfortunately, a lot of wokeism is actually deeply illiberal. And you said it so well in your question that I feel like I almost don't need to add to that.
Well, it's a wonderful response. And I think what you're, articulating, among other things, is exactly, something I've found right throughout your work, which is a spirit of real intellectual generosity. And there is, without wanting to absolve oneself of blame, I know that social media tends to do that. I'm actually very happy I'm not active on social media and haven't been for a while. So we've got a couple of minutes left, Amit. The one thing I want to mention, I want to end this on a slightly humorous note. Your blogs and the way you write is also very funny. And I remember years ago I read something, I had me burst out laughing actually, because I had the same experiences. You said that there was a story which you featured, and you said the moment I read the first three lines of the headline, I knew this was in India. And the story was basically that there was a train which stopped, and the conductor and engine driver told passengers, "Chalo niklo," and they were made to push the train. So, and something similar happened to me. There was some poor chap, some crocodile in a village pond. Balaram, Nambi, I don't know what his name was. He was 75. He passed away. He was vegetarian. So, now, is there something which is an India story, according to you? Like, what, according to you, is, I know we are getting into sort of exceptionalist territory, but what would you call an India story where, you hear, you just start hearing the headline, this can only happen in India?
Yeah, I don't even remember that train story or writing about it, but, both of us are kind of getting on in years, and it is possible that one forgets things. Yeah, Rohit, I can't think of a funny story for you right now. The first story that came to mind when you asked what is an India story is a story a friend called Veena Venugopal tweeted today. You saw that, right?
I didn't see. I know who she is. She used to work.
She's a journalist. Yeah, yeah. So she tweeted this story about how there was some school, some exam was happening. I think one 12-year-old boy accompanied his sister to the classroom. So he wasn't a student of that school. He accompanied her. She was giving an exam there. And he threw a chit at her at one point from the window or something. He wanted her to cheat. Now, the chit hit another girl, and that girl thought that it's a love letter to her. Presumably, she didn't open it and read it. But she went out and told her brothers. And then her brothers and her family came. They caught this 12-year-old kid who had thrown the chit, and they killed him. Right. And oh, and this is an India story. And I'm sorry, you want a funny story? Yeah, these are not fun. Yeah. These are not funny times. And I, these are, you know, and you know, this is what it is. This is our society. This is nothing to do with politics. And
And you know, you're right, because this is actually one of the many things also I thought we'd talk about. But of course, we, you know, we had such a wonderful conversation about other things. You know, if in some ways, you know, a dismaying conversation given the state of things in India, particularly just the incredible level of violence in Indian society, right? How pervasive violence is. I, even all the years I lived there, I still lived more than my half of my life here. In a few years, I would have lived more than half of my life outside. But I would sense it even then. And it would seem to me a big contradiction that we spoke about being a non-violent society. But this routine violence, right, which pervades everything, which is structured and, you know, inflected by and inflects caste and, you know, questions and gender and social class and so on. So, yeah. So, you know, it's a sobering note. And I take your point well, that these are not, you know, funny times and or humorous times, and that perhaps is a note to end on. I'll maybe just end by asking you, first I want to thank you, you know, thank you so much, and for doing this at such short notice, and really for all the technical advice as well, and helping us sort of get our game up. We've been operating sort of at a low-tech level, and thanks to the patience of all our listeners. So I know you're a voracious reader, and you read very widely. Just a quick way to end, what is something interesting that you're reading currently?
Currently, I'm reading a bunch of different things, but if your listeners want recommendations, then given all the things that we've been talking about, I feel I should give recommendations that kind of, you know, give insight on all of these, on and books that I've learned a lot about India from. One of the finest books I read last year in the course of recording my episodes was a book by Peggy Mohan called Wanderers, Kings and Merchants. And this really, in a sense, tells the history of India, including the ancient history of India, through our languages and how our languages evolved and
wonderful.
So on and so forth. Mm. And it's a masterpiece. It's just a great book. She was on my show as well, but I would recommend buy the book. It's a great book. That's one great book. Two books that go together for me whenever, you know, in terms of understanding our deep history. One is Tony Joseph's Early Indians. I'm sure everyone's read that, or they should have, which really looks at indisputable genetic evidence of, you know, our prehistory, so to say, where we came from and whatever. And the Big Bang sort of revelation from that book is that once all the migrations to India had happened, you know, you had the Indus Valley and you had different migrations, including the Aryan migration happening, which, by the way, is indisputably proved by the evidence now. You know, there was, in a sense, a kind of party going on for a long, long time, for centuries, until suddenly 2 millennia ago, about 2,000 years ago, that party ended, in the sense that the caste system became dominant. You had severe endogamy, which led David Reich to say that India, you know, if you're looking for large populations, look at the Han Chinese, but India is really a collection of many, many small populations. And that is what caste endogamy does, which also leads to incentives for female seclusion and so on and so forth. So to understand many of our deepest problems and where we come from, that's a wonderful book. And another great book, which to me is a companion book to Tony's book, is India Moving by Chinmay Tumbe, which is a documentation over the centuries of migrations within India. And a remarkable book. And and Chinmay is just a fantastic scholar. And the big TIL from that book for me is that the majority of internal migration within India happens because of marriage. Women get married and they move away to their husband's village or town or whatever, right? And this is, it's something that's bear thinking about, because, you know, most of us, people like, you know, including you and I, Rohit, think of history and society in such male-centric ways. And this kind of helps you take a step back and shows you another layer, another gaze through which to look at it. That I think that if you apply that gaze of what has life been like for Indian women, you get a completely different answer from the typical male-centric gaze that we tend to have otherwise.
It's wonderful. These are all fantastic recommendations, and again, open out possibilities for like infinite more conversations, right? Multitudes. Well, thank you so much, Amit. Really, really appreciate it. Since I'm piggybacking off your technology, I'm just going to wait for you to stop the recording, right?
So I'll
do I do that?
I'll stop the recording and I'll thank you for inviting me on. It's so good to talk to you, and we should really meet and have a bunch of meals. How many meals did we have that day?
Well, three meals. We will. Many more meals. Absolutely. All right, Amit. Take care. Thanks. Thank you.